discussion of Carl Hayden. As I said, Senator Hayden became chairman of the Appropriations Committee. And while much of his emphasis of, his public career was upon the development of the West, its water, land, irrigation, nevertheless, he also was a great help to, nevertheless, he also had an internationalist outlook. He supported President Truman, President Eisenhower, and President Kennedy in the great, in the efforts being made on the international front. He was a party man, trying to be loyal to a Democratic president, but at the same time, constantly watching out for the interests of his constituents. He had a tremendous interest in the development of natural resources and also their conservation and protection. I found him a man of gentle spirit, and even in his later years, of keen mind, and a wise man, a wisdom drawn from rich experience over a long period of time. He was one of the people that influenced my life in the Senate, indirectly, to be sure, but very positively. I went to him on many occasions to seek his counsel and advice on legislation, and particularly as it related to some of the needs of my home state. One of the other greats that I got to know was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Sam Rayburn. You could really apply the phrase, he was an unusual man, to Sam Rayburn, and it would ring true. He governed the House of Representatives from that Speaker's chair, as few men in his time were able to do. He was an advisor to presidents and a counselor to his colleagues in the House. He, like Barclay and Hayden, had a long service in the Congress. They seemed like they were a part of the whole of the congressional institution. They had developed with it and helped develop it. They had grown in stature and power over the years. Speaker Rayburn was without a doubt one of the most powerful and influential men in national life. It's often been said that had he not been from Texas, he could well have been president of the United States. Of course, later on, a Texan did become president. But in those early, but in the 40s, when Lyndon Johnson was yet a very young man in the Congress, Speaker Sam Rayburn was a powerhouse and looked upon as a potential nominee for the presidency. And as a matter of fact, he was being given some consideration in 1948. At the time when the Democratic Party was so divided, torn, and confused at the low ebb of the Truman administration. But the one quality that Sam Rayburn had, which stood him well, was his loyalty to the Democratic Party and to them and to Democratic presidents. As a leader and one of the outstanding leaders of the Congress in his years in the 1940s and 50s and early 60s, he helped mold national policy, but he also helped to carry out presidential programs. I got to know him particularly well when I served as the majority whip of the Senate. This was during the Kennedy administration and the period when Lyndon Johnson became president following the assassination of President Kennedy. Every Wednesday morning, we would have what the president called the Congressional Leadership Breakfast. At that breakfast would be the president and the vice president, the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader, and the Majority Whip, and the Majority Leader of the Senate and the Majority Whip. We dined with President Kennedy at 8 a.m. and would discuss with the president for an hour to an hour and a half the program for the week, and also, of course, many ideas and programs that were of long range. Of long-range purpose and time span. It was at these breakfasts that you became personally acquainted on an intimate basis with those who sat around the table. Sam Rayburn never said too much, but what he said was listened to. And generally was on target. I know that President Kennedy, welcomed his Rayburn's counsel and advice. In fact, he would frequently, at these breakfasts, probe the speaker as to what he thought could be done at the congressional level for a particular piece of legislation. President Kennedy never made a move on the legislative front without the closest coordination with the speaker. Speaker Rayburn was an intimate friend with Lyndon Johnson during the service of Lyndon Johnson as a member of the House of Representatives, as well as during his service in the Senate as Majority Leader. The Speaker and Lyndon Johnson would get together practically every day to discuss matters of mutual interest and, in particular, legislative strategy. During the years of the Eisenhower administration, both Speaker Rayburn and Lyndon Johnson extended full cooperation to the President on international matters and in particular on the development of the space program. It was Lyndon Johnson, as Majority Leader, who rammed through the Senate the authorization for the National Aeronautics and Space Agency, for NASA, and also the first appropriations. This was the effort made to catch up with the Russians after the launch of Sputnik. Speaker Rayburn and the House side gave the same kind of support and cooperation to President Eisenhower on the space program, as well as on the foreign aid and international policy. To know Speaker Rayburn was an experience itself. He was a taciturn man in many ways, often looking stern and literally glowering at people. But underneath that sternness was a keen wit and a broad sense of humor. Like many other politicians of the South and Southwest, he was full of yarns and stories about the people of his district and about his many experiences in the federal government. He was known to conduct what is known as the Board of Education, end quote, which was an informal gathering of some of his intimates and colleagues of the House and the Senate, where they would gather together for discussion of what was transpiring in Congress, but also, as he would put it, to strike a blow for liberty. Namely, a good scotch and soda or bourbon and branch water. These were men of temperance. These were men of moderation, however, both in their politics and in their personal habits. But they made politics more than an avocation. It was almost a way of life. And Speaker Rayburn was not only the wise and powerful man of the Congress, but he was also the diligent and effective congressman from his district in Texas. This man, like Alvin Barkley and Carl Hayden, had a knew so much about the government. There was practically nothing in the 20th century that had passed by them without their imprint or their knowledge or their knowledge of it. Speaker Rayburn had gone through the administrations of Woodrow Wilson, Harding and Coolidge, Hoover and Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower and Kennedy, and into the Johnson years. In all of this, he was able to maintain the respect of his Republican leadership, as well as the loyalty of his colleagues in the Democratic Party. He was a man of great personal integrity, impeccable character, and of intense loyalties to his associates and friends, and to the presidents and to the Democratic presidents that he recognized as his leaders. He always placed the country above the party, and while a true and loyal Democrat and the leader of his party in the House of Representatives, he never permitted his partisanship to overcome his sense of citizenship and his responsibilities to the nation. A memo to Norman in this book: we should get the original text of my civil rights speech in Philadelphia. That should be included on that section on civil rights. As I've indicated before, that speech was prepared in a most unusual manner. I had much of the dictation was done in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. My brother and I were rooming together, and we're rooming together, period. It was unbelievably hot that July 1948. There was no air conditioning. My brother liked to have a can of beer, and so he had used the bathtub to put a cake of ice and some cans of beer in that tub. I did a good deal of the dictating of that speech. I don't know whether I ought to put this in here or not. I did a good deal of the dictating of that speech, standing ankle deep in cold water while I was taking a shower, and asking my aide to take down the my comments or my dictation. The speech was put together in draft form, and then it was polished up after consultation with a number of my political associates. For example, I talked to my dad, who was there as a delegate from South Dakota. I read to him what I planned on saying, and I'll never forget my father telling me that he hoped that I had weighed the consequences of that speech. After all, he said, if you give that, it's apt to divide the Democratic Party. And my father was a regular Democrat, true and loyal to the party, and surely wanted no division in its ranks. What he wanted was a Democratic victory. But then he said to me, if you feel strongly about it, if you feel that this is something that must be done, then proceed to do it. But do it in a way that will rally the largest number of votes in support. Uh, be, make your stand, and realize that you're going to be attacked and abused and attacked and criticized for promoting or for inciting a division in the party. He obviously had a sense of what would develop, namely the walkout of many of the Southern Democrats and the formation of what was known as the Dixiecrat movement or party. Anyway, that speech was the result of both cool feet and hopefully a cool head. It was not long, and quite frankly, as I look back over it, it was quite moderate. But for the time, at the time that it was delivered, it was indeed a far-reaching and a far-reaching document. I talked over the contents of that speech with Andrew B. Miller, who was a congressman from Wisconsin and joined me in offering the minority report. I also talked over its contents before it was finally drafted and prepared with Wilson Wyatt, the former mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, and with Jim Loeb, who was the executive director of the Americans for Democratic Action. Jim has been a longtime friend of mine and is respected for his good judgment and being very level-headed. Also, the Washington attorney and activist in the ADA, Joseph Rau, R-A-U-H. And then there were some of my friends in the labor movement who were consulted. Saul Hoffman, the president, S-O-L Hoffman, the president of the Upholsters, the International Upholsters Union. Both Saul and I were strong Truman Democrats, even at the Philadelphia Convention. We had taken a position that was contrary to many of the ADA members at that convention. I also discussed the contents of the speech with my old friend Walter Reuther, so that it was given a considerable airing before it was delivered. Many of them thought it ought to be tougher. I thought that we'd gone as far as we should. Obviously, the speech spoke for itself. A little potpourri here. I'm going to try to just put down some anecdotal material that we can fit into the book here and there. Maybe a chapter just on people and places, people, places, and events. For example, when Dwight Eisenhower became president, he appointed as his Secretary of the Treasury George Humphrey from Ohio. George Humphrey's name was in the headlines time after time, but generally they left off the first name and just simply said, Humphrey says this or Humphrey does that. Well, I surely was not of the same political philosophy as George Humphrey. And yet, when I'd go home to Minnesota and get off that airplane at the airport, I'd have people come up to me and say, oh, I just read all about you in the paper today. I'd pick up the newspaper and wonder what in the world was the article. What in the world article was there about me today? And lo and behold, it would be an article about George Humphrey. You know, folks don't pay quite as much attention to political commentary as politicians do. We people in public life tend to feel that everything that appears in the press is something that we have to digest and regurgitate and then digest all over again. The average citizen, however, is busy with other things. He has his mind on his job, maybe his desire for a vacation, his family, or some personal problem or a personal desire. He reads the headlines and maybe the first paragraph or so, but what he really remembers more than anything else is the name. And believe me, the name, George Humphrey, was in the press repeatedly. And this was particularly true in the first couple of years of the Eisenhower administration. Despite the fact that I was marked by the Republican National Committee as the man to get in the congressional elections of 1954, And despite the fact that George Humphrey and Hubert Humphrey were as opposite in political philosophy as you could, about as you could get, I believe that the mention of George Humphrey in the press all the time out in Minnesota was a distinct asset for me. In other words, while the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee had listed me as the number one target, I apparently was a sort of a thorn in their side. And George Humphrey expressed an economic philosophy of the most conservative nature. I found that just the mention of George, just the mention of Humphrey, time after time in the press, turned out to be an asset. Another little item about George Humphrey: when Eisenhower came into office, of course there was a mass firing of top echelon people in the administration. In fact, the Republicans had been out of power since 1932, and they were going to make the most of their new victory in 1952. After all, they'd waited for 20 years, and they proceeded to clean house from top to bottom, and indeed engaged in wholesale investigations and accusations based upon rumor and innuendo, driving people literally out of their minds. Many people were not only embarrassed, but some people were the victim of false accusation to a point where it destroyed them. Well, one day I was sitting at my desk in my Senate office, in the Senate office building, and a call came in to my secretary, came in for me. It was received, or intercepted by my secretary, who came into my office and said, "Senator, the White House is calling." And I said, "Well, fine, let me take the call." So I took the call. And the voice on the other end of the line did not really wait for me to identify myself. They were new in office and eager to get rid of Democrats and hire Republicans. So this voice on the other end of the line from the White House said, "We have a man here, Mr. Humphrey, from Akron, Ohio, and he says that you promised him a job. Now, what do you want me to do with him?" Well, I thought this is the time for me to do a good, to do a favor for a fellow citizen. No one asked whether I was Secretary Humphrey or Senator Humphrey. So I said, "Why, give him the job. I made the promise. The promise was made, and the promise must be kept." At that point, the gentleman on the other end of the line said, "Thanks, we'll take care of it." I've often wondered who it was that got hired, and if the person who was hired happens to be reading this chapter in the book, I want him or her to know that I'm happy that I was able to do something for my fellow man during a Republican administration. Now, there was another, there were all kinds of problems with George Humphrey being in the Treasury and Hubert Humphrey being in the Senate. Our mail got mixed up, and day after day I would get letters addressed to George Humphrey, and George Humphrey would get letters addressed to me. We sort of had a courier service running between the Treasury office and the Secretary of the Treasury's office and my office. Fortunately, there was no mail that was of such consequence that it could cause any embarrassment. But one time, because of this confusion, I decided I should make a little speech in the Senate about the two Humphreys. And it went something like this. I said, "Now, there's the Eisenhower administration has a George Humphrey, and the Democratic Party has a man by the name of Hubert Humphrey. And the two are very different." I said, "Now, George Humphrey is a man who believes in the old economic philosophy of trickle down. And Hubert Humphrey is one who believes in the democratic philosophy of percolate up, democratic economic philosophy of percolate up. In other words, George Humphrey believes that if you just make the rich richer, that some of the crumbs will fall off the table to those below. And Hubert Humphrey believes that if you but expand and increase the purchasing power of the people, that some of it will percolate to the top, and enough of it to make for profits and for economic well-being for those who are at the top." So I said, "Let's get it straight. George has trickle-down George. The Secretary of the Treasury is trickle-down George. The Senator from Minnesota is percolate-up Hubert." That one little speech got a lot of attention, and it helped to clarify the differences between the two Humphreys. I found George Humphrey, however, a very affable and friendly man. One evening when I had given a speech to a Jewish organization, I believe it was the B'nai B'rith, convention. Flowers had been sent to Mrs. Humphrey by the leadership of the organization. However, to my Mrs. Humphrey, by the leadership of the organization. However, those flowers didn't end up at the Hubert Humphrey household. They ended up at the George Humphrey residence. Well, the next morning, on Sunday morning, I received a call at my home. We received a call at our home. I answered the telephone, and on the other end of the line was Mrs. George Humphrey. And Mrs. George Humphrey identified herself and said, what were you and George up to last night? And I said, well, now, Mrs. Humphrey, now, you better be, I said, I don't know whether you ought to be asking me a question like that. After all, George and I are good friends, but we're also in opposite political parties. She said, well, why do you ask? And she said, well, because I received a beautiful bouquet of flowers out here. And I just began to wonder if George had been up to something that he ought not to be and was sending me some flowers. Well, she had a great sense of humor. And then she went on to say, I believe that these flowers have been misdirected. She said, let me tell you, there's a card in it. And the card read, from the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith. And I said, well, I think it might very well be, these flowers might very well be from Uriel, because I spoke to that organization last night, and they may very well have decided to send Mrs. Humphrey some flowers. Well, she said, I'll send George over with them right away. And lo and behold, about an hour later, up came a big black limousine, and out stepped the Secretary of the Treasury, George Humphrey, personally delivering the flowers to Muriel Humphrey. So you see, politics not only makes strange bedfellows, it also brings together people who love flowers. And or should I say, people who get their flowers mixed up and then spend a little time untangling the branches. During the Eisenhower administration, my favorite target was Ezra Taft Benson, the Secretary of Agriculture. He espoused a philosophy of government and a policy position on agriculture, which was completely contrary completely contrary to what I believed. Secretary Benson was, to put it simply, a super-duper rugged individualist, preferring to leave the farmer at the mercy of the elements and the marketplace. Long ago, I'd come to the conclusion that the elements were unreliable and that the marketplace was like a jungle insofar as the farmer was concerned. Therefore, I had supported an agricultural policy that provided for effective fixed price supports for crop loans to the farmer so that he could hold his crop and market it at a time that was more beneficial to him, and a program cutting back on production so that the marketplace would not be burdened with surpluses which were price depressing. All of this was was opposed by Benson. He wanted no price supports, but had to settle for what the Republicans called flexible supports, which was only a way of flexing down the farm income. He was opposed to reasonable price crop loans, preferring none, but settling for a very low, to accept a very low loan rate. He wanted the government out of the agricultural business. In other words, didn't want the government to have an ever normal granary with any food reserves. All of this I considered to be contrary to good public policy. After all, the American farmer was vital to the nation, and yet the farmer was one of the most depressed areas. Yet agriculture was one of the most economically depressed areas of the country. Farmers were leaving farms by the millions and going to the cities, overcrowding our cities and ultimately helping to precipitate what we call the urban crisis. After all, the urban crisis, the urban problems have an opposite side of the coin, namely the rural poverty or the uneconomic conditions that afflicted so many of our farm producers. Benson became the proper target for a continuous barrage from some of us from the Midwestern states. I led that fight, and practically every day for 4 years, for practically every day during the time that Benson served as Secretary of Agriculture, I would rise in the Senate and give a speech condemning his policies, pointing out what they were doing to agricultural income, what they were doing to rural people, pointing out that these policies were driving farmers off the land into the cities, and also noting that despite all the efforts of the Republican administration to carry out their marketplace philosophy, that the prices were going down, farm income was going down, and surpluses were piling up. Ezra Taft Benson provides a case in point as to how to build an issue and how to pierce the armor plate of the opposition. In vast areas of the country, particularly the Midwest, the South, and some of the Rocky Mountain states, agriculture was a basic industry, vital to the economy. I proceeded day after day to chip away at the Eisenhower Republican Benson agricultural policy, so that by 1956 it had become a major issue, and by 1958 it was an issue that was decisive in some of the agricultural areas, in congressional districts and Senate seats that were up in those in 1958. Also during that time, we were able. Also during that period, I involved other senators, and one of them was John Kennedy, senator from Massachusetts. Jack Kennedy readily admitted that he knew little or nothing about agricultural policy. But I kept reminding him, particularly after the 1956 convention in Chicago, where he came very close to being nominated as our vice presidential candidate, that if he was looking forward to a national election, that he had to know something about agriculture. Well, he told me right then and there, he said, "I'm appointing you my Secretary of Agriculture right now here in the Senate." And I believe the record will show that Kennedy voted with me on practically every agricultural vote. I used to try to explain to him parity and crop management. And he would say to me, "Don't confuse me with those facts. Just tell me what's the right thing to do and what your farmers need, and I'll help you out." And it was on that basis that Kennedy got his introduction to agricultural policy. When he became president, he was reasonably well versed in the agricultural policy, and carried out an effective program for the benefit of our farmers. The Eisenhower administration had as its strong man, outside of George Humphrey, John Foster Dulles. Mr. Dulles was the central figure in the Eisenhower administration foreign policy. He had a great distrust of Harold Stassen. Mr. Stassen, first of all, the former governor of Minnesota, and one of the bright lights in the Republican politics of the 1940s, had been appointed the administrator of the International Cooperation Administration. I'll have to check the name, because that administration, foreign aid, was changing its name about every other year. I always remember Stassen coming before the Foreign Relations Committee with numerous charts and displays, sort of the Madison Avenue type of selling technique. Period. It was quite obvious that he didn't know much about senators. I heard a number of my colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats alike, grumble about the kind of Madison Avenue salesmanship approach that was being foisted upon them. Later on, Stassen left the job as was removed, or left the job as administrator of the Foreign Assistance Program, and became the director of an office set up in the State Department known as the Disarmament Office. It was here where Mr. Dulles crossed swords with Stassen again and again. And I had some good long talks with John Foster Dulles about this, because during that time I had become chairman of the Special Subcommittee on Arms Control and Disarmament under the sponsorship of the Foreign Relations Committee. This subcommittee included representatives included senators who served on the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, the Armed Services Committee, and the Foreign Relations Committee. Dulles never really trusted Stassen, and he made it very clear to me on a couple of occasions that he was really just worried over what Stassen was up to in this area of arms control. Norman, this may not be worthy of being included in the book. We may want to cut that out. Little item on Truman. I was an active supporter of fair trade legislation, the effort to protect the independent businessman from discount houses and cut-rate pricing and driving that businessman out of business. I came by this because of my long experience in the retail drug business with my father. I had seen what the chain stores and the discount houses were able to do to the independent merchant that owned his little business. He was simply unable to compete. And therefore, I supported legislation which would permit manufacturers to establish a price on their product, particularly name brand commodities or items, and that price had to be adhered to, or the manufacturer could withdraw from that distributor the commodity. This was bitterly opposed by the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. It was considered to be a violation of the Clayton Act and the Antitrust Act. I felt that it was essential legislation and supported it vigorously during my service in the Senate. Well, one bill finally passed around 1952, the name of that bill and the date. After it had passed both the House and the Senate, and I was its most active spokesman in the Senate, I went over to see President Truman about it. I had heard that he might veto it. I also knew that as a senator that he had supported such legislation. But now he was president, and he obviously was receiving the advice and the counsel of people on the White House staff, as well as those from the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. All of them, to a man, were opposed to this legislation. I went over to see the president and gave him my argument. He was kind enough to give me some time, and I gave him my argument. As I was leaving, I said to the president, "All I ask you to do is to bring any one of the opponents of this legislation into your office and give us equal time. Let them state their case and let me state mine, and then you be the judge. I know that you'll do the right thing." The president said to me, "Well, Hubert," after I'd reminded the president that he had once been for it as a senator, he then told me, "Now you know that I have many advisors, and I've got to look at these matters from the point of view of the nation and of the presidency." And I said, "Well, Mr. President, I know that after you hear the arguments, you'll do the right thing." He assured me that he would give it the most serious consideration. I went away feeling that at least I had made some impression. It was the end of the session, and Muriel and myself and the children were traveling home by car. We went up by the way of Niagara Falls so that we could see that beautiful sight. And while we were there, staying at a motel, I recall the evening that the manager of the hotel, a woman, came running down the sidewalk, literally shouting that the president is on the phone and wants to talk to you, Senator Humphrey. the White House is calling. The White House is calling. The president wants to talk to you. She was literally quivering with excitement. I got on the phone, and I never forgotten what the president said. He said, "Hubert, I just want you to know I've signed that damn bill. I hope it will do all the good things that you said it would. If not, you've got me into some trouble." So he signed the Fair Trade Bill. Another occasion, I went to the White House to talk to President Truman about some legislation known as the Basing Point legislation. It was a very complicated, intricate piece of legislation relating to the price that would be established on steel. In other words, the price would be at the base point, let's say, of either Pittsburgh or Chicago, and that the price would have to be the same within a particular area. The president was opposed to this legislation, as was I. The bill passed, and I went over to see the president and said to him and explained to him why I thought the legislation was wrong and injurious. I should have said that the president as yet had not indicated what his position was on the legislation. I tried to make a strong case against it and said to the president, "I hope now that you will veto it." He said, "Well, I'll tell you, Hubert," he said, "I'm going to give it a good, hard look." And he said, "I'll have to talk to the people in the administration about it, the Secretary of Labor and the Secretary of Commerce and others. But," he said, "I'm going to give it a good, hard look." And he said, "I'm going to be just like that old Missouri judge that had a fellow that came before him in court." And he said to this fellow, he said, "Now, we're going to give you a fair trial, and then we're going to hang you." He said, "Now, I tell you, that's what we're going to do. We're going to give this bill, this Basing Point legislation, a good, fair hearing, and then I think I'm going to veto it." Really, he said, "I want to tell you a little story that they use down, that they tell down in Missouri, about a fellow who had been brought into court several times. And the judge was getting a little weary of this fellow appearing. And finally, the judge said to the lawyers and the attorneys, he said, "Now listen, fellas," he said, "we're going to give this chap a fair trial. We're going to give this SOB a fair trial. Now we're going to give this chap a fair trial, and then we're going to hang the SOB." And he said that was the way he gave me the indication that he was going to veto the bill. And he did veto the bill. I was always impressed by the fact that in the Truman and Eisenhower administrations, there were a number of generals in key positions. But each and every one of them was, in a sense, a tribute to the American democracy. They were more civilian in their outlook than they were military. And yet our country had been armed to the teeth since 1940, had gone through the Great War, World War II, had to face up to the hard facts of the Cold War, and had been involved in the costly and terrible Korean War. And yet, a man like Eisenhower, a general, was really a civilian at heart, and a man who possibly understood more about the industrial military complex than most, and made one of the great speeches alerting the American people to the danger of too much military in the government and too much power in the industrial military complex. But there were others, like General George Marshall, who was such a great and marvelous man, a man of great character, ability, complete integrity, loyalty, who never conducted himself in the offices to which he was appointed, Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, and the President's personal representative to China, in any other fashion than that of a civilian. He had the greatest respect for the president and the office of the president, and for civilian control of the military. The same thing was true of General Omar Bradley, who after the war was appointed as the administrator of the Veterans Administration, and did more than any other one man to reorganize the Veterans Administration to make it a first-class agency of deep concern and of help to our veterans. It was under Omar Bradley that the whole medical program of the Veterans Administration was reorganized. And I worked with the general in those in accomplishing some of that. Then there was General Beadle Smith, who was our ambassador to the Soviet Union and was in the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency. Again, a great and distinguished general who had earned himself an enviable reputation as a soldier in World War II. And yet here he was in every sense more of a civilian than most of his civilian counterparts. It was people of this quality and character that helped our country during these difficult post-war years. They were the heroes, to be sure, of World War II. But more importantly, they were the civilian heroes of the post-war period, carrying out important assignments for the presidency, for the president, for the administrations that they served. I've always felt that these men were a better testimonial to the worth and value of democracy than anything that could be written or stated. The fact that they were military men who still understood the importance of civilian rule, who respected civilian authority, who were able to transfer who were able to shift from the uniform into the civilian suit, and in a military capacity and a civilian capacity, to serve their country with distinction and honor and duty. One of the emoluments or rewards of public service has been the opportunity and privilege to know men men of such great quality and character. I knew each of them and felt and knew that I was the better because of whatever contact that I had with them. And in this book, we want to get my memorandum following the funeral of President Kennedy. I was able to write down within the next day or two after that funeral my observations. That should go in its totality into this book, because it's much more specific than my faulty memory of today. Also, there is a report, I believe, on my visit to Italy in 1961 when President an item on the civil rights issue. I recall that in the early 1950s, after having become the target of the racists and the segregationists and the conservative editorial writers and commentators on the civil rights issue, as well as finding myself somewhat isolated in the Senate, at least in the first two or three years of my Senate life, because of my strong support of and advocacy of civil rights, that I decided that it was time to try a new tactic or new tack. The whole issue around civil rights at the time was the charge made by the Taft Republicans and others, as well as the Southern Democrats, that the federal government was trying to control the lives of our people, that it was statism, as they called it, that it was an interference in the private affairs of the people. The argument was against compulsory or enforceable fair employment practices, against any kind of enforceable legislation. There seemed the acceptable steps seemed to be voluntary this or voluntary that. In other words, it was considered statesmanlike to advocate a general principle relating to equal opportunity and equal protection of the laws and the elimination of discrimination and segregation, but don't provide any machinery to enforce the principle. There were a number of proposals advanced, for example, for voluntary equal employment opportunities. In other words, pious pronouncements, preachments, declarations of good intent and purpose, and even the setting up of machinery to bring about conciliation and mediation, but with no enforcement power. One of the proposals that had been made by the Truman Civil Rights Commission was the establishment of a national civil rights commission to monitor civil rights what was going on within the United States and to make a report to the President of the Congress once a year as to the advance in the field of human rights or the lack of progress or the injustices or inequities that were taking place. I decided that I was for this commission, but I considered it only one of the many steps that need to be taken. But the fact that it had no real enforcement power seemed to appeal to some people. So I thought I would offer the olive branch to my critics, and the South in particular. And I proposed in a special letter to a number of editors of Southern newspapers, a letter to the editor type of proposal, that we should join hands we should join hands in bringing about the establishment of a National Civil Rights Commission designed to monitor what was taking place throughout the nation in the field of civil rights, the protection of such rights, or the failure to protect the rights of all of our citizens. Of course, this was predicated upon the understanding that people did have these rights. It was this issue which ultimately came to the forefront. I thought that my olive branch proposal would gain support. Instead of that, it brought again a avalanche of bitter attack from the segregationists, the conservatives, and the southern politicians. At the same time, it also brought attack of sellout from my more liberal friends and those who were the militant, determined advocates of compulsory civil rights legislation. So the effort to be reasonable and moderate, to try to make some progress on a piecemeal basis, ended in even more trouble than had been generated earlier. I learned a lesson from that, namely that the only time to offer a proposal that is less than you want is when you have the oppositions to the point where they believe that unless they accept that proposal, they're apt to get something worse from their point of view. In this instance, they had no reason to be afraid, no reason to believe that I could pass any kind of civil rights legislation. So they turned their editorial pens and their rhetoric and their political rhetoric upon this most reasonable and sensible proposal and rejected it out of hand. And those who were the who truly believed in a strong civil rights program looked upon it as little or nothing, or at worst a sellout, and at best an abortive attempt to accommodate ourselves, to accommodate my position to those who didn't believe in it in the first place. At this point, I think we ought to try to get the text of that letter to the editor and at least include parts of it in the in this part of the discussion of civil rights. I think we can find that in our files or some of the news clips at the time. One of the events that I recall that is somewhat anecdotal or humorous is the time that Speaker Joseph Martin, a Republican of Massachusetts, and I were to address the National B'nai B'rith Convention in Washington, D.C. We both were to in Washington, D.C. I shall never forget Joe Martin, delightful old gentleman that he was, speaking with great feeling and constantly mispronouncing B'nai B'rith so that it read like Binny, birth, and he kept calling it Benny Berth rather than B'nai B'rith. An evening to remember. And I have a feeling that our friends of B'nai B'rith, the great Jewish fraternal organization, went away somewhat doubtful that Speaker Joel Martin really understood their organization or the many good causes for which they struggled so valiantly and often so successfully. 1967, we were traveling in Europe, and Mrs. Humphrey and I were privileged to be the guests of Queen Elizabeth of the United Kingdom and her husband, Prince Philip. We stayed at Windsor Castle. I shall long remember driving out in the British countryside and coming up to the portal and the entrance of that stately and historic castle. We were escorted to our respective apartments, and later on in the evening, in the early evening, we were the guests at a little family reception. Also present on this occasion was the British Prime Minister Harold Wilson and his wife Mary, both Harold and Mary being very good friends, personal friends of ours. Prince Philip, the Queen Elizabeth, Prince Philip, Prince Charles and Princess Anne were the members of the royal family present, along with the chief of the diplomatic corps, the ambassador from Saudi Arabia, the prime minister and Mrs. Wilson, Muriel and myself, and one or two others. On that occasion, I recall so vividly Princess Anne, a charming young lady, coming up to me and saying, "Mr. Vice President, don't you have coeducational school colleges in America?" And I said, "Indeed we do." "Well," she said, "we're just deciding now where I shall go to college. And I want to go to a coeducational school, but my mother thinks that I should go to a girls' school." Then she went on to ask me, "Don't you believe that a coeducational school, Mr. Vice President, is a much better educational institution for both men and women?" And I said, "Well, they're considered to be excellent schools, and surely most of our colleges in the United States, at least the far majority of them, are coeducational. However, of course, we have some that are specifically for men and some specifically for women, such as, for example, Radcliffe and Smith College, and I listed off one or two, Wellesley and some others." Well, she said, "I wish that you would speak to my mother and tell her that you think it would be wise, that it would be good for me to go to a coeducational school. She'll listen to you, and particularly since you've been a teacher, would you do that for me?" Well, I was somewhat dumbfounded as to what to do, but I had to say to the charming princess that I thought this was a matter that ought to be settled between she and her mother, and I doubted that that Her Majesty would want to have any advice on such an intimate and personal matter from a visitor from the United States. But at least this little incident demonstrated to me that even the royal family has the same problems and challenges that the rest of us do. I was much impressed that evening with Prince Charles, whom later on we saw in 1969 become the Prince of Wales at that magnificent investiture ceremony in Wales. During the evening, following the reception, we were entertained at a magnificent dinner, but again, it was a small, intimate group. Following the dinner, the Queen took us to a visit through the castle. We saw many of the great historic rooms, and we were particularly pleased and surprised to see the library. In this library, we She had arranged for a number of American documents to be on display, papers of Franklin and Madison, Washington and others. It was truly an Americana exhibit. We also saw the magnificent collection of Leonardo da Vinci drawings, which the British Crown had obtained over the years. Indeed, the largest collection of his sketches and drawings of any place in the world. That evening, following the dinner and the visit to the library and the tour of the castle, about 11:30 or so, we retired to our apartment. On the way down that long and magnificent hall, filled with statuary, and also, might I add, some children's toys, including a couple of tricycles, we stopped at we were visiting with Harold and Mary Wilson. As we came to the apartment that Muriel and I were occupying, I said to Harold, "Why don't you come in and have a nightcap with us? We'd love to visit with you and Mary for a while. After all, our talk during the evening, our time during the evening had not permitted too much of a personal and intimate talk with our friends, the Wilsons." Harold accepted our invitation, and we came into our apartment. Then I proceeded to look around for a bottle of scotch, or some wine, or champagne, or something. And lo and behold, there was none available. There was none to be found. At this point, I decided to tease my good friend, the Prime Minister, just a little bit, and in other words, to pull the lion's tail, just enough to get a response. And I said, "Harold, you English are the most ungrateful of friends, and after all, we made you a big loan. We've tried to help you following World War II, and under the most generous terms. We've tried to be helpful in many other ways. We are allies in NATO, and I come over here to your great country, and am privileged to be the guest in the royal household. And there isn't even a bottle of wine or a bottle of whiskey made available to be found anywhere." And at this point, Harold said, "I'll take care of that at once." He proceeded to go out in the hall and find a head butler, and within a very few minutes he came back with a bottle of scotch in hand, and he set it on the table and told us that when an American asks for something from Britain, that loyal and faithful ally quickly responds. And we sat there for a while and had ourselves a couple of good drinks prior to retiring. And as we were visiting about so many things, Harold looked at me and said, "Well, Hubert," he said, "this is quite an evening, isn't it?" He said, "It isn't too bad either when you stop and think of it. Here we are, just a couple of ordinary fellows, one of us the son of an English school teacher, the other the son of a small town druggist. And here we sit in the Queen's castle, and here we sit in Windsor Palace drinking the Queen's whiskey. Not bad for just a couple of boys who are trying to make good." That fellow, Harold Wilson, once again demonstrated why he was a political leader. He had a good sense of humor, as well as a commanding presence. In order to understand the politics of the 1950s and indeed the 1960s, it is important to realize that the Republican Party had been out of power from 1933 to 1953, 20 years. Only once did they have a majority in the Congress, and then a very slim one, and that was in the 80th Congress after the election of 1946. President Eisenhower was the first Republican to be elected to the office of president since Herbert Hoover. Now, all of this adds up to a pattern of bitterness, of frustration, of bitterness, of rabid partisanship that continued to grow with increased intensity and fury. During the Roosevelt years, it was customary to hear bitter attacks, to hear and read bitter attacks upon President Roosevelt. And during the Truman years, those attacks were intensified and accelerated to a degree that became became irresponsible and at times even dangerous. The 80th Congress represented, of course, the letdown and the backlash of World War II all over. In most of the democratic countries, there was this kind. There was this rejection of the war leadership, the strains of war, the sacrifices that people were called upon to make, the controls over prices and wages, the shortages of goods and materials, all of the discomfort that people were put through, all of this all of this put together. Broke out in what you might call a political in political revenge or in political retaliation. Therefore, the party that was in power tended to suffer losses and, in some instances, serious defeat. For example, Winston Churchill, the great leader, the war leader of Britain, was defeated even as he sat at the Potsdam Conference with President Truman and Joseph Stalin. And the labor leader, Clement Attlee, became prime minister. Churchill's Conservative Party was defeated, and soundly. In the election of 1946, the Republicans swept to a victory in the congressional elections, and President Truman found himself besieged on all sides by his critics in the press, in the public, and surely in the Republican Party, and even amongst Democrats. There was, for example, Senator William Fulbright suggested that the president resign and permit a Republican to take over. There were suggestions that a Republican become Secretary of State, a coalition government be formed. Every conceivable kind of criticism was hurled at President Truman. All of this was but a culmination of the growing frustration and bitterness and bright partisan anger and irresponsibility that was a growing phenomena during the 1940s up into the 1950s. In the election of 1952, when Eisenhower defeated Adlai Stevenson, it may well have been said, as you look back at it, that despite the fact that Adlai Stevenson was a brilliant man and thoroughly qualified to be President of the United States and would have brought great honor and distinction to the office, that the election of Dwight Eisenhower permitted some defusing of the explosive nature of American politics. In other words, a Republican just had to be elected, or the Republican part. It seemed that a Republican just had to be elected, or the Republican Republican leadership would become ever more cantankerous, angry, irresponsible, and bitter. I lived through this period, and was able to see it and measure it. In the period from 1950 to 52, the question was whether it would be Taft or Republican that would be the leader of the candidate for president. It is my judgment that the nation was fortunate in that it was Dwight Eisenhower that prevailed, even though Robert Taft was a strong political leader for his party. Dwight Eisenhower was above all an internationalist. He understood he understood the nature of, he understood the post-war world. He understood America's responsibilities in and to that world. And despite his lack of political experience, his command of the his command of the United States armies in Europe had given him a preview of some of the problems that the world would face in the post-war world. Likewise, Dwight Eisenhower had been brought in by President Truman to head up the NATO forces. And NATO was actually more than a military alliance. It had taken on a political coloration and character of its own. Therefore, Dwight Eisenhower was accustomed to working with the leaders of Western Europe. He was aware, he surely was more than aware and sensitive to the problems being posed by the Cold War and the constant pressure of the Soviet Union upon the West. So when you look back at it, we may very well have, when you look back at it, even as a partisan, you can say that Eisenhower's victory helped cool the political temperature and bring some reason out of the irrationality and some sense of calm out of the political hurricane which was sweeping the American countryside. The background, I doubt that it would have been possible for a Democratic president to have dealt with incredible emotionalism and passionate partisanship of men like Bill Jenner of Indiana, of Dorshak of Idaho, Carl Mundt of South Dakota, the Stiles Bridges of New Hampshire, William Noland of California, and indeed Joseph McCarthy Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, and Bob Taft of Ohio. Many of these men had considerable ability, but it was being consumed in incredible partisan anger and frustration. Democrats, the Democratic president, another Democrat in the White House, after 20 years of Democratic control, was more than the Republican Party could take and still maintain any sense of reason and balance. I witnessed this growing sickness when I came to the Senate in 1949. Robert Taft was the leader. And he was a partisan from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. He was on the attack. He had a working coalition with the Southern Democrats, and he was determined to be the opposition. As he put it one time, the duty of the opposition is to oppose. He did not even add the descriptive word of the loyal opposition. He was the opposition, period. He did not feel it his duty to present alternatives, but rather to oppose. And oppose he did. He opposed the president, he opposed President Truman with everything at his command. And while he was a man of considerable ability and talent and of good character, he permitted his he did not use his position of leadership in the Republican Party to curb the incredible radicalism and militancy and irresponsibility of a man like Joseph McCarthy. Democratic administration was hammered away at with political battering rams. The rhetoric was torrid. For example, it was the Republican leadership in the Senate, in the House, at the National Committee level, and indeed almost every spokesman charged the Democratic administration and the Democratic Party with what they called statism, that's the power of government over the people. The word statism became the rallying cry. And then it was the welfare state. And that was worked over and hammered home as if the administration was promoting what was known in Britain as the welfare state. The cry of socialism was used again and again. Soft on communism was charged repeatedly. The Joe McCarthy period, the Joe McCarthy attack was the epitome of demagoguery and political irresponsibility. And yet, seldom did a Republican leader speak up to even restrain him. In fact, I think it can be said that he was encouraged to carry out his wild accusations. Proof and truth had little or no place in the political spectrum. It was this kind of political environment that plagued the nation at the end of the 1940s and the early 1950s. To be sure, Harry Truman was able to gain a spectacular victory in 1948, but he did so against almost insurmountable odds, and primarily because he was able to demonstrate to the American people that the Republican 80th Congress had not acted in the public interest and had failed to attend to the public's business. Nevertheless, in that campaign, the rhetoric and the demagoguery that was to plague Harry Truman's administration was unleashed. And from the day of his victory until he retired in 1953, January 20th, 1953, he never had a day of rest, nor was he ever spared from a slashing attack by the Republican leadership. It was in this kind of social and political environment that President Truman advanced his bills and his legislative proposals to repeal the Taft-Hartley law, to authorize a national health insurance program, to call for a comprehensive civil rights legislative program, to ask for a massive housing program, to improve and expand the minimum wage program. These and other legislative proposals were advanced by the president only to be subjected to merciless attack by the Republican opposition. Added to this attack from the Republican opposition were the allies of the editors and the publishers of most of the nation's newspapers. These men in the main were conservative and were indeed political allies of the Republican Party. They accused the president of fiscal irresponsibility, They accused the Democratic Party, almost. They accused the president and his administration of everything from disloyalty to stupidity. The headlines were commanded by the attackers rather than those who were proposing, hopefully, some constructive solutions to the nation's problems. Then came the war in Korea. At first, Senator Taft and the Republicans in the Congress joined in commending President Truman for standing by, for ordering American forces to help the beleaguered people of South Korea. But when the tide of battle turned and American forces were being driven back, those same Republican leaders, headed by Robert Taft, turned on Mr. Truman, charging him with incompetence, demanding that we get out of Korea and bring our men home. How well I remember the letters that were how well I remember the letters from constituents. The Fulton Lewis Jr. On the radio, the commentators of press and radio, stirring up the people. Letters would come in by the hundreds, showing just how confused the American electorate was. The same letter that demanded that we cut the budget, reduce taxes, slash expenditures, would also ask for increased price supports or better mail service, even though the Post Office Department was running at a deficit, or insisting upon a public works program, and then that same letter would demand that we get out of Korea, and in the next paragraph insist that we defeat the enemy, drive the Chinese out of Korea, and win the war. There was neither sense nor reason to much of what was being said and much that was being heard. And in these incredible circumstances, a president was trying to govern, and some of us in Congress were trying to legislate. The code words for the politics of the late 40s and 1950s from the opposition point of view were statism, welfare state, socialism, communism, and corruption. It was these words that were used freely, extravagantly, and recklessly to attack the Truman administration and indeed the of course the Roosevelt administration. But they reached their fury and to a point of white heat when during the presidency of President Truman. He fought back, and he did so both with attack against those who were leveling their verbal barrages at him, but also by presentation of program and, of course, the remarkable successes or the remarkable initiatives that he undertook in foreign policy. It is a miracle that he was able to bring about a bipartisan foreign policy. His Greek-Turkish aid program passed through Congress after months of harassment and bitter debate. His efforts to help feed a starving and prostrate Western Europe under UNRWA had less trouble, but he took the chance of drawing down American food reserves almost to the very, very bottom limit. His proposal for a Marshall Plan for Europe fortunately had the understanding and support of a man like Arthur Vandenberg and others who place country above party and humanity above partisanship. The NATO alliance was not, the NATO alliance and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization were subjected to long and long, tedious, and strident debate, with Senator Taft leading the fight against the proposal. And then long after the accomplishment of the alliance and the Marshall Plan, there were the efforts of men like Senator Bricker of Ohio to curb the powers of the president in the fields of foreign policy and to place restrictions upon the presidency that at the time seemed, that at the time would have severely weakened the determination, and the initiative and the determination of the American nation in the period of the Cold War and for the rehabilitation and reconstruction of Europe and Japan. The war hero, General Douglas MacArthur, seemed to fit neatly into the bitter partisanship of the time. He is an acknowledged egotist, just as he is an acknowledged military, just as he is an acknowledged great military leader. Truman's dismissal of MacArthur was the climactic act that stirred the opposition to frenzy and an attack upon the president, the likes of which had not existed since the time of Lincoln. The Republican conservatives wrapping themselves in the flag and baptizing themselves in the waters of patriotism prepared to do battle against consummate evil as they saw it in President Truman and the Democratic Party. MacArthur, who was already a hero, became a superhero. He was invited to address the joint meeting of the Congress by the leaders of the Congress. He was heralded all over the nation by those who were already opposed to Truman but found new reasons to step up their attack. But found a new reason now to step up their attack upon him. MacArthur lent himself to all of this willingly. And it was only because the president insisted upon the doctrine of civilian control over the military, and because a few brave men, like the late Senator Robert Kerr, and the former governor of Minnesota, Luther Youngdahl, stood by the president, that he was able to weather the storm and permit history to permit time to restore reason and judgment to the whole incredible situation. All you can say is that when people are out of power too long, are beaten down, are beaten at the election box again and again, turn away from the politics of reason and order, and readily submit and readily accept or subject themselves to the politics of confusion and emotionalism. Names like Robert Taft, Kenneth Wherry, William Nolan, Stiles Bridges, Owen Brewster, William Jenner, Homer Capehart, Dworshak, Carl Mundt, Herman Welker, and Richard Nixon were just some of the warriors of the late 40s and 50s that had committed themselves to unrelenting attack, regardless of the consequences, upon the Democratic administration and the policies of the Democratic Party and leadership. They were relentless, they were persevering, they were determined, they were reckless. And it was only by the election of Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican, to the presidency in 1952, and his coming into office in 1953, that the storm was calmed, that the storm was brought under some control, and that the hope for a more rational and sensible approach to the nation's problems became a possibility. Even then, there were at least 2 years of trial and travail before the political process was restored to anything resembling sanity and coherent policy and reason. I should have added that in all of this bitter partisan Republican partisan attack, there was the cry that the Democrats, and particularly Mr. Truman, had lost China, as if somehow or another we had owned it, controlled it, and were in charge. The so-called China First lobby, whatever it was, surely was at work. The damage done to our State Department and Foreign Service during this incredible period of demagoguery and irresponsible attack will take many years to overcome. The healing will take time, and the nation will have paid a grave and heavy price. Surely there were those in government who must have realized that if they were to tell the truth as to what they saw abroad, and that the reports were to be filed with the State Department or our security agencies, that there were those in those agencies that would leak those reports. And if in any way they showed any indication of portraying that the communist movement or party or regimes were making headway or were waging a successful political war in faraway places, that these reporters, these men of the Foreign Service and the State Department, would be branded as either soft on communism or fuzzy-headed liberals, or incompetent. In other words, whatever was to be portrayed or said had to be in the extremes. It was either that everything that was happening in our relationships with the communist world was evil, bad, and wrong, or that everything that we did was noble, right, and sound. And of course, politics is much more complex than that. And in times of rapid change, when empires are tumbling and social orders are disintegrating and value systems are changing, it is very difficult to be precise in what you see or what you know. In fact, if there is one quality that is needed, it is patience and the use of time to gain objective observation and understanding. But those who were disgruntled and those who had suffered